I will also be looking at the chat. So if you've got questions as you go along, please do put them in the chat and I'll try and bring them into our conversation. So this is our third Red Talk in our business resilience series, where we're going to have a look very specifically at how food and farming businesses can access finance and how best to use finance to drive long-term performance, with emphasis both on farming but also widening aspects of opportunities for green or natural capital investments. On our panel today, we have four people. We have myself as chair, Louise Manning, Managing Director of LGM Associates. We have Ian Hawthorne, who is Managing Director and Founder of Avaris Advisory, who has a lot of previous experience in agricultural banking. And we have Mark Lumsden-Taylor, who is Founder and President of the Rural Policy Group, but also has a wealth of experience in not only land-based and agricultural accountancy, but also in green payments and green finance. So I'm going to start with you, Ian, if that's okay.
Of course.
Over your part, oh, Martin's just arrived, so that's really good. Hi, Martin.
Hello, eventually.
Lovely to see you. And I'll quickly introduce Martin. For many people on the call, Martin will need little introduction. Martin is, I would describe Martin as a farmer, and we're going to talk a bit about his farming business, but I would also say he is an influencer of current policy, both at national level and also very much focused in Herefordshire and the development of policy there. So I was going to start with Ian, but I'm going to switch to Martin
That's
now.
fine.
And so, Martin, putting you on the spot straight away. So, with current international and national situation, could you just talk us through and really ground us by talking about how the situation was last autumn and now, and how that is influencing your farming business?
I'll go back a little bit further than that, in that it has seemed that the political landscape has changed in the last few years in policy. And I'm getting old, as you can tell by the look of me. And I thought, what am I going to do over the next 10 years to make myself in a better position, as a business and as a farmer? And so the last autumn, yes, everyone was feeling quite content. We'd had a dry harvest. There was very little in the shed, which was the downside of it. Fodder was expensive. I was selling fodder to local farmers, although I haven't got much myself. And I had half a shed of wheat. I took the decision last year not to grow any cereals this autumn, last autumn. And I'm still quite happy with that decision because, as has been seen, despite the situation in Hormuz and the situation around the world, it seems that the global stock hasn't allowed the price to go up. And so I'm sitting here thinking, I'm glad I didn't spend money on that because I'd be spending more now. I've changed my business quite heavily over the last 5 years based on exactly those principles, in that it seemed that the direction of travel was that a business that was like mine, a bit of a broad acre, mainly rented inland farming system, perhaps wouldn't look so resilient. And so I've changed cropping decisions, gone into SFI, done everything the government should ask of me. That's a background to that, really.
Oh, that turned my audio off. Thank you, Martin. And you've also been involved with landscape recovery and a whole range of environmental projects in Herefordshire, especially around the Wye Valley. So are you happy to, as a starter, just to give us a bit of an overview of some of the things you've been involved in?
Yeah, absolutely. In 2020-ish, there was a lot of noise kicking around the River Wye to do with around poultry litter, around phosphates, around water quality. And it just seemed that there was no pushback. I'll say pushback, that sounds very combative, but no representation coming from farming to resist that pressure. So a friend of mine, Kate Speak Adams, who runs the Herefordshire Hub, and I decided that perhaps we should put our hands up and say, look, we can do better. Let's take ownership of this and let's see what we can do to influence the people in the region, in farming, and influence perhaps government as to the realistic ambition of the river and the realistic ambition of farmers. So to provide them with the ability to produce and to equally look after the water quality and try and improve the wine. So I put up initially and everybody wanted to take a picture of me. And
Ellie and
have my face all over everywhere, which was very good. It was lovely to have your picture taken. However, putting your hand up doesn't answer the questions. And so paddling underneath like a swan, we had to put together some systems by where we could do some peer-to-peer learning and we could embrace some of the schemes that may come forward. So now that has ended, or so far got to a landscape recovery scheme that initially the farmers poo-pooed a little. And now we have a 5,000 hectare scheme and 5,000 more hectares of people wanting to come into that scheme. That's waiting for government approval. But all those things took 4 or 5 years. Government coming, ministers of various governments coming to visit my house and visit the river. And it's hopefully changing the dialogue a little bit. Although today, if you're watching this on the day of the webinar, there's the largest environmental court case has gone to the High Court based around the Wye. And so there's still the pressure there for us to improve.
Okay, thank you, Martin. Thank you for giving the background in your own farming context in terms of the fluidity and change with financial resilience and how you're having to manage that as a business, but also the changing in requirements for the environment. And perhaps we can talk a little more together about where some of those, where the opportunities are for financial support for the nature or environmental elements. So if I could come to Ian now. Ian, you've been involved with banking and your wider consultancy for many years. Where do you feel we're right now, building on what Martin said, in terms of financial and environmental resilience?
I think from what I've seen over the last 10, 15 years, from a bank's viewpoint, the more predictable and stable a farm can present their cash flow, their profit, the greater likelihood that the bank is going to support them. So every farm, of course, lives with incredible uncertainty, be it input prices, weather, political changes, market demand, always under a form of threat of some form. I think it's sort of really, as Martin has sort of outlined, the more a farm is willing to change, and as you mentioned, Louise, find where the opportunities are, funding will always be available for the ambitious farmer. You'd have a bit of a red flag or a warning sign, I suppose, for want of a better expression, that if a farm, when you're talking to them, says, this is the way we have always done things, so that's what we're going to carry on doing. If it's successful, fabulous. Don't rock the boat. Don't change anything. It obviously works. But be mindful of those threats that might be out there and how you might then have the ability to react to those, to survive when a farm is under threat of some form. I call it levers. What levers can a business or a farm pull in order to make them more stable, perhaps? But there was a great word that many years ago I was told we should look for from a lending perspective is thrivability. How likely is it that the farm or the business is likely to thrive? What's it got that you could say here's how good this farm is. Is it the people? Is it the soil type? Is it the location? What is it that actually combines? But I think, yeah, it's about being able to adapt and be resilient. But if you're really looking at from a financing perspective, it's cash flow resilience. And that, of course, can lead to that's natural diversification territory. If you are moving, or if you're thinking, how do I make my cash flow, my business more stable and predictable, then maybe you do something else. So we then start to look at tourism opportunities, rental opportunities, those things that actually just diversify away from the core risk, but give you a bit more ability to sleep at night, perhaps. But it's an entrepreneurial sort of instinct, really, not to be happy with what you've got, to always seek something better. And environment around that is just going to be the language that banks start talking about. There's a lot of requirements now that are imposed on banks to find out about the environmental dynamics of who they're lending to. So be expected to answer questions on that, or questionnaires, or some form of how does this farm relate to the environment? Is it supportive? Is it not? What is it doing? It will just become a feature, really, of typical lending decisions. How is the farm relating to the environment? Don't dismiss it and expect that just to be something separate. It's going to be part of the language.
Can I
So
ask?
I'm just going to come in and then I'll come to you, Martin. So I was on a panel last week and I was sitting next to a farmer who is based on the outskirts of London, and they have 10 million people within an hour's drive of their farm. So when it came
Fabulous.
to diversification and changes, they have got a captive audience. If we move to Herefordshire, where Martin is, there's about 180,000 people in the whole of Herefordshire. So many of the things that you're talking about are quite context specific. So I'm going to
Yes.
come to Martin now, and the point you'd like to raise.
Yeah, you mentioned thrivability. Do you think the thrivability of a farm as farms in general, as a percentage, is increasing or decreasing with the option of new markets? And secondly, how does a farm get some value out of that environmental piece, whether it be through the banking, it may be that they get a grant, or maybe they get a loan, or they don't. Where does the value come back onto a farm within that space?
So I'll let Ian answer and then I'll come to Mark, because I'm sure Mark's got some things he'd like to say on the topic.
I think a lot of banks will be quite rewarding if you present the environmental plan that the farm has. So there's incentives, for example, that banks might offer: discounts on arrangement fees, discounts on interest rates, these sort of things. So they're actively trying to incentivize farmers transitioning, for example. So there are specific facilities that could be accessed where you can, I hate calling it a tick box exercise, but as long as you can meet the criteria that they actually set out, then talk to them about what they are before you may then get to actually applying for something. Because one thing that was great about my job is that I got to talk to so many different farms of all different sizes, family backgrounds, and everything was everyone was different. And they've got this huge richness of ability to go back into their client banks or their credit policy and say, what are the things we're looking for that we know work? So sort of accessing that type of thinking, really, what do they see as being really good? I can't imagine how many farms I've spoken to over the years, hundreds, hundreds. And you just get a good feel. As a farmer has a feeling about what they're doing, the banker has a feeling about it as well. But this assumes that there is a relationship banker that is actually willing to come out, or at least talk to you and understand this stuff. It's not universal across banking. And forgive me, I can't remember the first part of your question.
It was the percentage of farms that have thrivability. Is that diminishing or is that enlarging?
I would say enlarging, but it's born out of having to survive. If things feel perennially getting worse and your back's to the wall, you can sell off bits of land, you can sell some stock, you can do all the things that sort of keep you ticking over. But it's ambition, really. That was one of the things that I just loved about what I did in my role, and now is that you, when you find a really ambitious farmer, and you sort of lock in to how they could have a fabulous future as opposed to just survive, it's that really. It's sort of born out of necessity, but I think farmers just genuinely need to be more ambitious. But it means risk taking. It means changing the DNA of the farm in some ways. You've got succession in there as well. But I think ambition is one of the key things. And actually want to do it, to realize the benefits, take the risk and do it. But it's hard. It's really hard.
So I think that's a good segue into Mark.
Yeah, thank you. And I just want to pick up Martin's point actually before I kind of talk a little bit more broadly. Are farmers more aligned to effectively what was said by Ian? My answer would be probably a little bit of contrast is if you take the whole sector at the minute, right now, no. Given what's gone on over the last 9 months, I think people are quite nervous and reticent to take those risks with a rider that there are pockets of it, which is, I think, Ian's point, who are have been historically entrepreneurial. And what goes hand in hand with that is often generational shift, where people are either retiring or the next generation is taking on, and they are looking for all the things that Ian talked about just then. So I think you can't use a one size fits all in terms of, I'll use the term entrepreneurialism. However, at the minute, the industry, and it comes back to the what I'm going to talk about, needs a clear and clarity in terms of its voice. And I'm not just doing a segue shout for the Rural Policy Group. The reason why that was established and set up, and it wasn't just me, was there's always talk about agriculture core, but you've got to look at the whole chain. You just mentioned the piece around why and what's in. I'm actually seeing a huge screen in front of me in our offices with that on there at the minute because we see the news 24/7. But you have to look at the whole thing from the perspective of the grower or the producer or whatever, right the way through the chain, all the way up to the top in terms of the end consumer. And that could be global as well. And that's when the chain is understood more readily. And I think until farming has that voice and has that profile within policy and decision making, those things won't change. In terms of what the topic of conversation is today, which is around finance in effect and what finance means, I've been in this space probably far too long, and the opportunities that you see mean different things to different businesses, whether that's at the production end or whether that's in the manufacturing end, right the way through to that relationship between multiples and ultimately the consumer. There is environmental opportunities. There was a huge discussion and debate about biodiversity net gain a number of years ago and carbon credits and sequestration on land. The credibility of that was highly questionable. And I remember a conversation I observed in the Farmers Club with some very well-dressed people in chinos and tweed jackets talking to a gentleman of significant age, trying to convince him to allocate a huge proportion of his land to effectively carbon credits. I think it's still the Wild West. And if you look at European Commission rules and European approach to regulation, it's still not been done because it's almost unregulatable. However, and this is an important point, what has happened in 26, and I will give credit to this government, they've started to use government policy with the Green Book, which is basically government regulations around financing. And they established the ENCA, which is the enabling a nat, I'm looking at it on my screen, enabling a natural capital approach guidance. It is guidance only. It is not legislation yet, but it's the start of trying to bring into line all these schemes, whether that's biodiversity credits, generation cash flow out of green assets, for want of a better phrase, but it's still a evolving space. And what I would say, I've dealt with some of the largest companies in the United Kingdom who are listed to some of the smaller ones. Trying to do this alone without proper understanding is really high risk and often results in a cataclysmic waste of money and a very small return on investment. For businesses in this space, Martin, and Martin and Louise, what I've seen is you need to have a mixed portfolio. You can't rely on things like BNG as a quick cash winner to support the main business. It's a bonus. And until the core business is effectively functioning the way it should be, and I'll use an example of, you won't mind me saying, Ollie Harrison. I think he's got 13 independent companies within his little empire. And one of the things he said, the reason I do that is because the core business doesn't pay. So I've got everything else around it to make the core business pay. So green finance and the addition of that, notwithstanding Ian's point about banking, and I will stop in a moment, is a bonus and shouldn't be considered as a core anchor because the policies are continually evolving. And just to give you a very technical point here, investors like green stories, of course they do, but it's totally linked to geopolitics. And if the politics change, they don't like them anymore and they start to change their view. And it has to be auditable now. It's not sufficient just to say, oh, yeah, we've sequestered 800 million tons worth of carbon around these, 2,000 acres of orchards. It's got to be tested now. And it can't just be by Pete and Dave's Audit Testing Company Limited. It's changed. And I think businesses in this industry need to recognize that. And with regulatory reporting going on the back of it, you're going to see a real shift in the next 9 months. My best guidance and advice wearing my hats is if you want to get stuck into this, you must talk to proper qualified experts and perhaps do it as a collective. We ran a collective for 20 million liters of milk a year back in my day, and they all went to their advisors collectively as a group, and it was far more cost efficient. So I'll stop talking at this point, Louise, but just my take on it, and we can talk into the technical detail of finances and options for this, but I think the point is it does always come down to risk and then cash.
So we're seeing a number of farmers. Martin described one approach with landscape recovery, but we're also seeing other farmer clusters coming together to reduce risk for an individual farmer by pooling the natural capital and the potential for green finance. But one of the, and Ian's been talking about levers, but the biggest lever is confidence. And as we've seen, even with the landscape recovery bids that have gone ahead, there's a 1 year break clause for the government in terms of payments. We're seeing challenges around payments for environmental services and environmental goods for farmers with the SFI, not knowing whether they're actually going to get any money next year for farmers already in the schemes. So there's a lot of uncertainty, as a result, many people are not willing to go in to some of these schemes. Martin, have you got any examples of levers, as well as confidence, but others that can help bring farmers together?
Farmers l like listening to farmers, and peer-to-peer learning is as good as anything. It starts whether you're in the pub, whether you're at the paddle court, or whether you're at a meeting of some description, or on social media. Peer-to-peer learning is fantastic because it feels like it's from a trusted source, even if it's wrong. And I know that sounds a really bad phrase, but farmers like talking to farmers, don't they? When it comes to third party advice, it then becomes very tricky to get the trust of a farmer based on something new because agriculture is a cultural system and we all live in that culture and have been brought up in that culture. And so, change, although we're very good at it, actually, we're not very willing participants unless we've got the correct advice on the way into it. So, let's go back to the why. That's taken 3, 4, 5 years to get change in attitudes from farmers to think about what they're doing with manure, think about what they're doing because it becomes the norm. And that's a cultural change. So doing that by someone coming up with drive, knocking on the door and saying, you must do this becomes almost onerous. And so how do we get that soft transition is a question I was going to quiz Mark with. Where do you go for that trusted advice? If it's not a farmer, where do you go?
If Louis, can I answer that?
Of course.
I'm sorry. I'm very conscious that you're in the chair, so
No, of course you can.
I'm being very good. I think you hit the nail on the head there, Martin. And how do you deal with that? I think it takes time. So I've presented to numerous farm networks and events, and you build those relationships over months, and I would dare say years. And it is only then, and this is where the dichotomy or the problem comes in. This is kind of, I suppose, linking into RPG, is sometimes you don't have years to get onto this stuff because it's available now and it's there for a particular period. And you're dead right about the farmers. And often advisors to those farms that could be have been in generational, like been there 20, 30 years, who have been their accountants or their chief, company they go to for their inputs for dairy, for example. Same salesman has been there, for 20 odd years. I think the only way you can deal with that is that collective voice of getting everybody on the same train, and then they trust that collective voice, and they may have advisors in it, and then that collective voice shares that information to the likes of you and groups and networks and others, and then they go, oh no, that's from Group X. Oh, we know them. They're trusted. We've seen them around for a couple of years now. They're making sense. And I think that's the only way that people will listen. Because I've sat with farmers over the years, and you can talk through it, everything, and they'll go, yeah, but we don't really know you. You might have been working with them for a year. We're not really completely sure. And I think risk is a big issue for farming. And it's what I said earlier about that compartmentalization. And until you balance that out, which is difficult given the weather and given geopolitics, it's almost impossible. I suppose the answer I'm giving you is from networks, I think the trust can be built. Can it be built immediately? No, absolutely not. Advocates like you, I suppose I kick it back, I suppose, talking to then your colleagues and your peers, I think potentially that could work. But then the trust has to be with me or Ian or Louise, whoever else concerning, has to be absolute. And I'm not sure how often we as a profession deliver that.
I think I'll just quickly jump in that the word trust is absolutely key. It takes extremely long time if you're new into an industry to be, particularly farming, to be trusted by it. The thing that I was able to do is a bit of, well, as you'll go back the stage, thing I never did was tell a farm how to farm, a farmer how to farm. It's ultimately theirs. But you can share stories all the time. So to make a sort of a plug for a good relationship bank that has experienced individuals is ask them what do they see other farmers doing. So you can share stories basically, but trust in farming, I mean, I've seen instances where farmers trust their accountants, trust their banks over 30, 40, 50 years, but actually they don't really earn it. The bank or the accountant doesn't really earn it. They're not adding that much value. So trust becomes incredibly important. But earning it takes, and demonstrating it takes a lot of investment in order to do that. But you're dead right, Martin. I learned many years ago that if you can bring farmers together, just get out the way. Just bring them together and let them talk. That environment is just great. Everyone will share their stories, how they do it, why they do it. Farm walks. I love the East Kent Fruit Society, for example. I go on the farm walks or the Biffa farm walks. Great. Everyone's chatting. They're really good. You're really good. It is, just learning from peers, dead right.
So do we need to invite more bank managers on the farm walks then? Is that the key?
Yeah, why not? They should be banging on your door to come. But again, they'll learn. So again, you can, I mean, I used to work for Oxbury. You arrive at a farm walk and think, who's this guy? But you've got the Oxbury brand. You think, oh, okay, so he's sort of maybe in our world. But you start to talk and you start to, you earn your stripes, your credentials, your reputation, but it does take time. It's trust. Absolutely, it's trust.
So to bring it back to some of the economic aspects, we've got return on capital for farms in England. The median return between 2014 and 2024 between 0.5% and minus 0.8. Profitability is stagnating. We've already outlined that for many businesses, cash flow or even and the ability to lay down cash is really difficult at this moment in time. Martin's explained how he's adopted a specific risk strategy this year in terms of broadacre crops, and next year he might adopt a totally different risk strategy. And we've talked about a whole range of things that in a benign world, we have time for trust, we have time to build relationships. We're in a situation where we don't have time for many businesses. How do you think we can build some of these quick wins? I'm going to start with Martin.
Building quick wins. For certain sectors, I just don't see a quick win, unfortunately. I think cereal production in particular is under out in on its own in a very snowy environment. I just don't see a charging white horse coming along to save it. Other sectors, obviously, they're varying in their output at the moment and varying in their returns. You look at the poultry sector, they're living quite well, thank you very much. However, I don't see with a free market system where the white charges are coming along. And it comes back to, like Ian was saying, the resilience of your business as to what you can achieve from it. I read a report, and there's a report that we've shared that the government have written. And if you, it was based on the incomes from 2015 to 2021, I believe. And if you read through there, the borrowing that within agriculture is very, very low, which is almost astonishing when you find that the cash flow situation is not great. So, at what point, where is the reality within those two spaces? Is the cash flow bad? Yes, it seems to be by the people I speak to. Is the borrowing very low? That's more of an Ian question. And where's the white charger? The white charger is in. Everything's always done. People make money on fluctuation, don't they? They make money, traders make money on whether somebody wins and somebody else loses. The unfortunate thing is that farmers are the passengers in those ebbs and flows. And so at some point, 12 months ago, dairy farmers were making good money. Within 3, 4, 5 months, all of a sudden, they're not making money at all because of oversupply to a degree. 3 years ago, grain was making money. Now, because of a decision made in the Strait of Hormuz, grain is looking absolutely desperate for this autumn. And I don't see where the white charges are coming from in an unsupported environment. If the government were, if we are going into dynamic alignment with the EU, are we looking at dynamic alignment of support? That's not been mentioned, and I suggest it's probably not going to happen. Although the CAP, they're actually cutting their budget for support for farming by, I think, 22, 23% this next couple of years. So even that isn't like the great long panacea that we're expecting. So I think farmers are on their own. I think that the example that Ian gave of Ollie Harrison, who's a good friend of mine, with multiple in diversified incomes, is the mixed farming of the future, perhaps.
That was
And
me.
maybe, yeah, or was it you? Sorry, Mark.
No, it
I'm
could have
dissing
been me
your
with
I'm
Ian. You're
dissing your
completely
contribution.
different.
But mixed farming has to be the way forward. It always has been pretty resilient. And the mixed farming now involves off-site income. I'm renting out units, I've
Yeah.
got solar, I've got utility bits and bobs and rentals. We have to be mixed.
Can I just add to that?
Of
Louise, you say,
course.
you know, what are the immediate things? And it comes back to you're not going to change culture overnight, number one. As Martin and Ian both rightly said, you know, 20, 30-year relationships. However, the world has changed. My industry has changed completely. Whereas before we could charge X amount of thousand for some basic advice, you can go into AI and do it. It's all there. It's all there. Totally changing accountancy business models. And for those of you that read the FT, I think KPMG have just taken out 10 or 15% of their workforce globally. It's huge. Big changes in my world. However, so we've got to adapt to change. However, for farming, and the debt point is a really valid one. it's always been a fairly prudent industry because of the nature of fluctuations. That's a fact. That is an absolute fact. However, if the model now is diversified rather than single crop production, full stop, fingers crossed, it all works out and happy days, then that should be the model that is then promoted to government because that's where we are. We can't go back to 1920, you know. And I think that is an important lens change because, yeah, Ollie Harrison's got all of those multiple units. However, it doesn't take away from the fact that we need to push the core business in terms of the fairness and what the government does with food production. That's a whole separate conversation. But those other opportunities like BNG, carbon sequestration, looking at working with investors for returns, the points about covenants on bank loans to get a lower rate of interest. All of that almost should become custom and practice rather than, oh, it's an add-on. It's part of the cultural shift in terms of how you run a company. If MH ran our business the same way we ran it in 1995, we wouldn't be here today. We'd be merged, would have disappeared, had to evolve, change, and adapt. And I think that's perhaps one of the key messages coming out. We could do a whole list of all those opportunities, Louise, that are out there. And the government is trying to get businesses to do it. But there is that reticence. But I think it's like that cultural shift of business. Wherever you are in the chain, wherever you are in the chain, because you've always got some levers to pull, but it's how you pull them. And I don't think that's, I think that's where farming are a bit reticent.
So
Sorry.
before I come to Ian, so inertia is often seen by many businesses, not just agricultural businesses, as the least risky option. But in an uncertain and fast-changing world, you can get left behind very, very quickly. What role, Ian, do you think banks can play, and advisors to farming businesses in helping farming businesses navigate where this portfolio of income is going to come from?
I think partly because they are now, I guess coming back to the point I made earlier, in my previous role and currently, I get to see many different farms doing many different things. So they can offer support and guidance to a point. You can't become a shadow director and into a consultancy role if you're a bank, but you can sort of offer support and guidance as to the likely things that the bank would support that they see as being successful. So, as you imagine, between was it 2010 and 2020, base rates were about 0.25% or something. It went down, stayed down for an extremely long time. So, the case for capital expenditure, the case to invest in something because money was cheap, was quite easy. If I can borrow money at 1%, 2%, but I can generate 3 or 4, great. But if you're now looking at a base rate of 3.75, and also, actually, back then, you could say the banks were maybe more competitive. But now you're looking at a borrowing cost of 5 or 6. You've then got to generate something above 5 or 6% as a margin in order to justify that base case of if I borrow to invest, here's my payback. So, as much as, for example, around the environmental schemes that farmers would look at, this is the environmental impact. Most of the decisions are purely financial first. So, we borrow, we invest, we do this. What environmental benefit does that have? I didn't get that many really, where it was environment first, and then we stack the investment case on top of that, really. So yeah, I think it's all about being able to, and particularly if you think as well, those returns you mentioned, 0.5% positive to minus 0.8, you've just got to be really confident that the payback case is really clear, and a bank would help you sensitize it, run through scenarios, lots of what ifs. What if this doesn't happen? Have you thought about this? What if, what if, what if? And if it comes to a point where it still stacks up, as it were, under questioning or test or stress, then everyone should agree, let's support it, let's do it. But it's money is just simply not as cheap. And with, the inherent economic uncertainty, as we all might feel as consumers or householders, if we're under threat, we sort of hoard our cash a bit. We We batten down the hatches a bit if we think our house price is going down, if we think we're going to lose our job or our mortgage cost is going to go up. We all sort of just, turn in on ourselves and hibernate a little bit until we're a bit more happier about things. Are we ever going to be happier about things in the future when we're in this state of almost perma-crisis? You can never really predict what's going to happen next, tomorrow, next week, next month, whatever. It's just having simple fundamentals of, does my investment feel right to do? And where are my blind spots that I might just need to make some sort of thinking around to cover those what ifs?
And before I come to Martin, so one of the challenges many farmers have, especially around green investments or around diversifications, is you've got your ABC or your John Nicks, which will give you a whole set of data.
Yeah, absolutely.
But how do they know what good looks like? If you are going to rent out some of your buildings for alternative use, you are going to look at using your fields for a whole range of different activities that may be linked to tourism or nature or water quality improvement rather than planting wheat. Where do you go to get that insight into what good looks like?
Yeah, that's maybe to Martin's original point, is that you need to talk to lots of other people doing it. There's lots of information online, there's lots of data sources, AHDB, these sort of places that I would think can give you that information.
And Martin, from your
It's
point,
benchmarking, in other words, forgive me, sorry, Louise, cut. It's benchmarking. Find the benchmarking data and say, is this significantly better or significantly worse than the typical benchmark, and why? Boil that down.
And Martin, from your point of view, that diversification in Herefordshire, there aren't many chimney pots. There aren't lots of businesses. I go back to what I said about the farm that's got 10 million people within 1 hour's drive. What are your thoughts on where you get an idea of what good looks like, what reliable returns are, whether that's slowing water down on your farm through a scheme, whether that's planting trees or renting out your buildings?
Well, tourism, I think, is the largest amount of money gained in Herefordshire over and above farming. So there is a space for tourism. Tourism also has gone through its ups and downs just recently with COVID, and then people finding they can go abroad and the weather may be slightly better. So even tourism comes with its own risk. There are the farmers in Herefordshire, let's use Herefordshire because I live here, they are quite investors. They're quite high investors. They don't mind it spending a lot of money. So there are multiple drinks manufacturers now, whether it be gins, vodkas, or champagne, actually, or even soda water. But those are quite big investments. When it comes down to marginal investments, you've got a fair few shepherd's huts kicking around now. You can stop in a shepherd's hut wherever you like, really, I think, in Herefordshire. But will that become a saturated market? I was talking to someone only this morning, looking at paddle courts, that they're hoping to sort of get a fair return on investment, 30,000 for a paddle court per year as a return, which seems very good. And based on agricultural return, it's an absolute no-brainer. But that again goes against that cultural question, doesn't it? So going back to Ian, I picked up on a couple of things you said. If I can ask you a question again, I'm so sorry.
So
I've sort of tamed what I do on farm from being this broadacre chemical spiller, spraying chemicals on wheat all through May and June, into a more grassland and high value cropping system. I'm not sure that I'm contributing much more to GDP. In fact, I think I'm contributing personally less because the output is slightly different. I'm not as busy. I'm renting land to different people. I'm growing crops myself, but it's not as busy as it was. How do you feel borrowing will change, or if it will change based on GDP? And do you feel that agriculture is being led into a direction of less output, or do you feel it's being led into, and you'll say, yes, but it's being led into a more profitable output. Do you
It's
feel
a
that's the correct transition.
Yeah, it's farmers, I wonder, or you could maybe say, are under no obligation to feed us. You don't have to farm, you just do because that's what the name above the door says, or the family says. But you have this enormous asset, which is your land, your buildings, your equipment. So it's a quick, it's just, you could really, from a strategic viewpoint, a business viewpoint, is that you boil it down to what would be a good strategy for the asset that I have to make me more thrivable, predictable. It's what do I do with the asset? But there is one big point which you can cross. Because same example you said about the shepherd's huts or the tourism side to what you're doing. You may get to this point when trying to borrow money or how you're viewed by the HMRC is, are you a farm with a tourism business attached, or are you a tourism business with a farm attached? So you can cross a point which becomes quite meaningful for borrowing, because you're suddenly no longer really treated as an agriculture business, which has one policy and one sort of set of divisions within a bank. Or you may then flip to a tourism business with a farm attached, and you have to be treated completely differently. So it's a question of be careful what you do, but it's still all about what is the best use of the asset. And then, but a lot of time, a bank should put themselves in your shoes and say, if I was Martin, would I do what he's doing? Why would I want to work really hard and live with shocking uncertainty when I can have an easier life, but just, operating more as a business than a farm? It's just rationale, and does it make sense? But not all bankers, perhaps, or accountants maybe have the ability to sort of think from the farmer's side. What would I do if I was this person? But admittedly, yep, you might then ultimately do something that has a lower output. But if it's less stressful, slightly more predictable, why wouldn't you do that? Why
Does
wouldn't you do that?
that help? Does that help UK Agriculture PLC?
Not at all.
That's the point. I was just,
You're under no obligation to feed us,
it was a
really.
really good segue actually to kind of why we're even on this is, does this country want to take food seriously and be self-sufficient of a particular percentage, or does it not? And I think that is ultimately that the fundamental point. And you're right, farmers don't have an obligation. But it's, for want of a better phrase, custom and practice for the last X amount of hundreds of years. Politics has a life cycle of 3 to 5 years, depending on which government is in. Agriculture, in terms of investment and development, the return on investment is way longer than that, unless you're in a really highly profitable niche. I dealt with a food business that was. So 3 to 5 years was a payback period. So until that's dealt with, which coming back to Martin's point, that yeah, it doesn't do Agriculture PLC any good, but it's framing the narrative. If Agriculture PLC UK is still really successful by being diversified and has got better outputs, better margins, better position, that's a good thing. But I think the British farming or food industry, it needs to be very clear that we either are a food producer and looking after our nation, and that is a key political target, irrespective of who's in office, because everybody needs to eat, whichever color you are in office. Or it isn't. And it's the same with that kind of net zero target, which has remained since Johnson put it in 18, but it's becoming more of a political football at the moment. So for me, that's the same principle. And I know we've gone slightly tangential, but I also think it's the reason why RPG was set up. Sorry, that's a plug, Louise. Couldn't help it.
That Mark's point is the critical thing, is we are introducing such risk into the food supply chain, where we're almost, where we are not being incentivized to produce British food. What on earth are we doing from a big strategic view point, the politics downwards? If the governments change every 4 or 5 years, but a farmer has to think about a 20-year cycle in what he does, how the hell do you exist within that? Hard.
And the real challenge, as I was saying to a group of farmers last week, if it doesn't make a profit, it's a hobby. So if you've got an enterprise on your farm that doesn't make a profit, it's a hobby. And one of the things that we've identified is that mindset for individual farmers, that in a post-subsidy world, direct subsidy world, that they are going to have to focus on profitability. There are some really difficult decisions to be made. There may be opportunities through green finance, but equally that might be from non-commercial and moving away from direct food production or feed production. We've only got a few minutes left.
I've
In
got
yes.
one. I've got one quiz I'd like to ask Ian.
Okay.
When it we Mark spoke earlier of the transition from an aging population of farmers into a next generation. How do banks feel about young people coming into agriculture? And do you think there's something they can be helped with to be that vibrant, thrivability sector?
Yeah, it's
Great
there's a
question.
lot of financial education needed. The financial awareness of young farmers, if they think, if you imagine they're going to inherit a large farm, large amounts of debt with enormous complexity, the financial literacy of younger farmers, the finance industry needs to do something about dramatically. Because I've been out young farmers events, all sorts of things. And I talk about what I think are quite simple things, but actually you can see them almost glaze over, really. So, not that I'm boring, but I try to sort of boil complex things down into really sort of simple ways of helping people understand them. But yeah, the financial literacy of farmers, young farmers perhaps, should be absolutely front and center. It's what the industry is doing to help that. There are loan facilities that helps new entrants to farmers. So there's a lot of help goes around that. But otherwise, I don't think there's really anything out there apart from, farm business management courses at universities, for example. Guys I've worked with remember their farm business degree, but they didn't really listen to the finance bit. They were too focused on the growing and the farming bit, and a lot of sort of knowledge moves from older generations to younger generations about farming. Does the financial literacy really follow that down? I don't think so.
So
Same problem
we've
for
got
20
about a
years.
minute left. So Mark, in summing up, what are your thoughts on that and other key points that are takeaways for people listening?
I would say, don't be frightened of change in terms of looking at green finance, looking at green options, but do it collectively. I think Martin's point was about, that bringing farmers together where they like to talk and chat. I remember that from my Hadlow College days. And so that's number one. Number two is it's okay to be diversified, provided you still retain the core business. And number three, which is pretty straightforward, I suppose, and I say this in numerous events I do. The farming industry is highly fragmented. It can be extremely insular. Sorry, that's probably a bit provocative. But if it joins up collectively behind one unit, whether not suggesting RPG, but whatever it is, not necessarily the NFU, because it's just solely about farming, but the industry does, then you will be able to change government policy. And I know this from personal experience, but just rhetoric and random reports have no bearing. And I think farmers just get really tired of it. I just think they've just had enough. And I think that's farmers in the food chain like clarity. So let's give them that. They're my three takeaways.
Oh, thank you. And Martin, to finish, what's your key takeaway?
My takeaways are, yes, collaboration is great and chatting to people is even better. Secondly, the future is in our youth, and so they need some sort of education or help or incentive to be able to carry on those businesses. And thirdly, thrivability was a great phrase. And there are some fantastic businesses around this country based on farms, whether they be farming businesses or whether they be diverse, they are fantastic. So let's not talk ourselves down too much because we have got a fantastic industry we should be proud of.
Very much so.
And Ian, you've got about 45 seconds,
That's
so.
all right. Very quickly, test your ideas until they break. Whenever I sit down with a client, we work out under which point their plan or their business fails. And if some of those risks are manifesting themselves, what do we do? And they can be external, things that you sort of can't predict, or internal. Is it simply a lack of classic business skills? Is it a lack of awareness from politics to economics, that sort of thing? So internal and external threats, test it until it breaks and see how you feel at that point.
Lovely, thank you. So thank you to the three people on our panel today. I've enjoyed the conversation. I hope you have too, and the people that are listening. And I hope that you come to another Red Talk soon. Thank you.
Thanks,
Thank you.
Louise. Very well
Thank
chaired.
you. Well done.
Thanks,
Bye.
Louise. Thanks, both.